Well, I'm going to take you far, far away from marches of a million people. I'm going to take you far, far away from crime. I'm going to take you far, far away from the present. I'm taking you back into the long forgotten past, the fossil past, because joining me in the studio is Professor Lee Berger. And was it only last week that the announcement came?
Absolutely. It came out on the 12th and sort of built up through that week. Yes.
It was very carefully built up and everything. But I can remember you coming into the studio, was it 18 months ago?
That is exactly right.
Been on holiday with your family.
That's right. And I showed you a little picture in my family scrap album.
Yes.
And I said, watch this space, Jenny.
And this is the space.
This is it.
Now, for people who haven't heard the announcement, who maybe haven't seen the pictures and what, let's bring them up to speed in the first place.
Well, in short, what I found while on that holiday and then have subsequently elaborated on through many visits back to Palau, Micronesia, a little island on the western Pacific Rim, is a tiny population of extinct humans, maybe some of the smallest humans that have ever been discovered on the planet, that have sort of thrown themselves into the Flores-Hobbit debate, so to speak, in shedding light on just how far we can push human variation, how far we can mold this physical form of ours and stretch it and make it look primitive, that is ancient, or make it look advanced. And these little people, because they were trapped on an island between about 1,500 and 3,000 years ago, shrunk and adapted to that island, inbred quite a lot, it looks like, and may form the first case of what we call island dwarfism to have ever been observed in humans.
At what stage do they become a separate species?
That's a really good question. And I must say, during the course of investigating these fantastic fossil finds, my colleagues and I debated that a lot. You know, when is a fossil species something new? And did we have that? We came to the inconclusion after examining the many thousands of bones that we had, that what we had was not another species, that it was a experiment, a stretching of the limits of modern humans, mind you, but was not in any way a new species, because it didn't have a combination of characters that we could say, hey, this is not us. Could we find any individual Palauan alive today? I'm not sure. But could we find them within the realm of humans that have lived in the last few thousand years? Absolutely. And obviously they were that.
The when I say normal Palauans who are wandering around today, are they small? Are they
small? No. They're great big people. You know, they're 1.7, 1.8 meters tall. They're these typical
robust
Polynesian descent type people with some Austro-Melanesian in them and are really big people. In fact, we found big people. We found big people at about 900 years ago. They are, you know, big strapping warrior types. You know, you're kind of what you envision coming over the horizon in an outrigger sailing canoe. Our people look nothing like the modern Palauans. I mean, the females were probably right down around a meter tall, and that is really tiny.
That's the size of a dwarf.
That's
in
adult height. That's right. And these are as small and maybe just a bit smaller than even the observed range of living pygmies, African pygmies and Andaman Islanders, very, very small-bodied people. And they also carry a lot of things that modern pygmies don't do. For example, their faces proportionally shrunk. That is that their faces shrunk to their body sizes. And their heads are very, very tiny. They're probably just at the low end or maybe just outside the range we've had until then. Observed in modern humans.
They also have very, very small jaws.
Yeah, they have. That is one of the most interesting things about the Palauan. Another thing that we demonstrated to scientists of the world with this find was that things like a chin, and you've had me on here before and we've talked about what it is to be modern, you know, the definitions of modernity. One of those is a chin, we always say. It's having a chin. What we showed is that when you shrink the body very, very rapidly under these island conditions, one of the things that goes is the chin. And the reason it goes is because the teeth can't shrink quick enough. Believe it or not, not, these little tiny Palauan people had teeth the size, well, in the upper 5% of variation of modern humans. They're as big as the largest human teeth we find, shoved into a tiny, tiny, tiny little jaw, and thus it had to change its entire shape.
So what you're saying is that these people arrived on these islands, normal size, and they adapted very, very quickly in the same way that elephants can adapt within 2 to 3 generations to living in a forest or to living in extreme conditions, whether it's a desert or whether it's snow. They also adapt very quickly in terms of ear sizes and foot sizes and things like that.
Absolutely. It's called island dwarfism. And in many, many other large animals, we've seen this happen where things like elephant-like animals get onto an island and they shrink in size to a dog over very, very few generations because there are very few resources on islands.
And is that why? Because my next question obviously was, does it mean if you go and live on a glorious tropical island that you're going to shrink?
Well, you know, one of the funny things, if you lived on that glorious tropical island and had a very restricted type of diet and you weren't sharing your genes with people visiting the island, it appears that that's what happened. These people, or at least the hypothesis we're working on, and we'll be going back to investigate this further, is that they got their normal size, and within a remarkably short period, and I mean a few hundred years, they shrunk to this very tiny size and evolved all of these strange characters. And it was due to, one, the island being very stressful. Believe it or not, on Palau, there were, several thousand years ago, no large terrestrial animals of any kind. No mammals, no reptiles. So you land on an island, and there's not a lot terrestrial to eat at all. Mm-hmm. The plant diversity is very limited. They were kind of restricted to coconuts and a few other edible plants and betel nuts so they could drug themselves into a stupor commonly. They had to survive on nearshore marine resources. And if the population was small that founded it, which it almost certainly was, because this is, remember, this is pre-navigable sail. This is before people had sailing outrigger sailing canoes and could navigate across water. So almost certainly they arrived there by chance. So it could have been a tiny population. They may have even been related. And that has its own effects on yes. as they start breeding from a very small base.
You say at a certain stage that you might have thought that they suffered from microcephaly.
Well, that's an argument for Flores. The debate that I've now found myself in the middle of is one of the most hostile debates that I think has ever occurred in the field of paleoanthropology. And as you know, that is saying a lot because we do have the propensity to fight with each other a lot. But this Flores debate has been one of the most remarkable divides in all of the human sciences. And literally, you have a scientific community on one side that you can call, quote, the pro-Flores people, the people who say, this little human that was found on the island of Flores that has this tiny brain of about 450 cubic centimeters is a brand new species, Homo floresiensis, and it's one of the most remarkable species that has ever been discovered. And then you have right on the other side of that room, you have the people who are against it who say, you have not found a new species. What you have found is a pathological human, bad luck for you, that was suffering from something like microcephaly or cretinism or any one of a number of other disorders that haven't been identified. And these people are at war with each other. And now I drop – and what they were asking for, the reason Palau is so important, is that they've been crying for 4 years to say, okay, find us a small-bodied island population that's undergone island dwarfism that has all these unique characters of Flores. Well, Palau is that.
Now, I've got to ask you the question that occurred to me when I was speaking to you last time around, 18 months ago, when you made the first discovery, when you were there on holiday with your family and your wife and whatever, and infuriated everybody because you suddenly started working all over again, when you found a whole lot of bones. It's inconceivable that they had not been found before.
And in fact, they had been found. They just hadn't been seen for what they were. There were a couple of reasons for that. Palau was the center of a major World War II battle. On the island of Peleliu was, I think, the third largest battle of the Pacific. And so the caves that litter these many hundreds of islands are full of the remains of that war, and that includes soldier remains, Japanese soldiers, American soldiers. And so there is kind of a feeling that when you see bones in caves, that may, in fact, be a World War II victim or something like that, and thus there's a kind of hands-off approach. Second to that is that these caves had been the center of some low levels of tourism. That is, that kayak tours had known about these probably for 5 or 6 decades, for all we know, but people hadn't really seen these bones for what they were. That is, that they didn't recognize they were tiny. They didn't see that the morphology, that is, the way they looked and the unique characters, they just didn't pick them up, probably because, you know, not a lot of fields of science work that closely with human remains the way we paleoanthropologists do. And even more specifically, maybe being an African paleoanthropologist, we're more attuned to working with small-bodied populations. That is, that when I saw those features, they immediately struck me as extraordinary. And so I reacted maybe in a way that others – I don't know that any other paleontologists had ever seen those bones, but certainly some archaeologists had.
But they didn't see it because they were looking for their own discipline.
That's right. They were looking for the pots and the tools and the things that archaeologists do. And funny enough, there's a huge message has come out of this for me. As an explorer for National Geographic, one of the things that I'm always looking for is ways to help science. And one of the things that came clearly through for me out of this is that we need to work at helping other scientists see the world. You know, we may look at the world a lot, but often we don't see
it.
And, you know, if this is sitting on this one island, how many other things like that must be on the tens of thousands of islands in the Indo-Pacific? How many other things like that must be stretched across Africa that people have already seen and just haven't really understood that what they're sitting on can change the way we view ourselves and can change science.
Well, how would Africa do that? And by the way, just let me reinforce that the lines are open, 8830702. You can SMS us, as always, 31702, and standard SMS rates apply. And I'm chatting to Professor Lee Berger, and we're talking about his discovery. And we're talking about, first of all, the first discussion that I had with Lee about these small human beings was a cave on the island of Flores in Indonesia, about 600 kilometers east of Bali, and that's where a species of hobbit-sized humans was found, but that was back in 2003. And then, of course, the recent discovery, and it is exciting, and is this very, very small race of people on an isolated island called Palau. And it's kind of way above Australia, sort of north-southeast of the Philippines. It's in the middle of the ocean.
It is a dot.
It's in the middle of the ocean.
It really is.
And difficult to get to.
It not only difficult to get to today. I mean, it takes quite a route to get there by air, but it was also difficult to get to in the past. The currents are just right to miss Palau. And so, and that's probably one of the reasons isolation like this could occur. People would be swept up above Palau and they would be swept down below Palau into the islands of Yap and Okinawa and Iwo Jima along this island chain, but not to Palau. And so, in fact, Palau, the archipelago, was one of the last island chains in the whole of the Pacific to be discovered by European sailors.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that comment you made about Africa. Now, there are two lots of people that I know of in Africa who were very, very small. One was the Bushmen.
That's right.
And there are photographs of them with Europeans below the armpits. Oh, I mean, very, very
That's
small,
right.
Fine-boned people.
Let me put in perspective how small the Palauans are.
Okay.
If you took and San or Bushmen are in fact the third smallest people on the planet. Pygmies, the African pygmies being smaller, and Andaman Islanders. There's also a group of Filipinos that are very, very tiny. But to put that in perspective, our males that we found, the males are as small as the females of the smallest pygmies on the planet. That is, people like the Andaman Islanders. So the males are right there at the bottom, and our females are, in their mean, actually smaller than what we would expect the norm of pygmies to do. But there are some pygmies that probably get as small as the Palauans. We just didn't really know that until relatively recently.
I mean, I'm trying to think, and I think a lot of people are trying to think, give it to us in the age of a child.
Okay, well, you're looking at something around the size of a five-year-old maybe a six-year-old.
Fully adult.
A fully adult.
Fully functional. Yeah.
Put your hand, you know, at your waist, depending on how tall you are. You're not going to be more than, you know, a few centimeters off of the height of a female.
But the extraordinary thing about this is that they were normal height, in inverted commas, before they came onto those islands. And then within a period of 300 years, they had shrunk. And that is because of what wasn't and what was on the island.
That's right. And it may be the first case that's ever been demonstrated of that occurring in humans.
And it's known as island dwarfism.
Island dwarfism.
Now, are there places in Africa where the same thing actually happens because of maybe the same kind of thing? Because maybe jungles can make for an island.
Deserts and jungles do that.
Exactly.
And culture can do it.
Yes.
You can actually choose to be separated and remove yourself from breeding with the rest of the population.
Indeed.
Although it's darn difficult to do for several hundred years when you're on a large landmass. It really does to make these extraordinary changes. It really does take an island.
So you will get an odd traveler and they will bring their genes into
that. And you mess it all up.
Okay, chatting to Professor Lee Berger. If you've got any questions, give us a call, 883-0702. It's very exciting. We're pushing the frontiers back. I want to know how old you've got to be in order to be a fossil. I thought you had to be 50,000 years old or maybe even older. Camilla, Eyewitness News. Sorry, I had to do it. Okay, so we're chatting to Professor Lee Berger and we're talking about these fossils. How old do you have to be to be a fossil? Or is it got nothing to do with age and everything to do with condition?
Have you seen some of our professors at Vits?
No. I'm not going down that road.
No.
It's to do with conditions.
Yes, it does. And that's not an easy question to answer in the sense that things can be many tens of thousands of years old and not fossilized at all. That is that they haven't changed. They haven't been replaced by minerals that are not present in the original bones, or it can occur remarkably rapidly. In the case of the Palawan situation, it did occur remarkably rapidly, and that's due to a very, very unique geological situation. The Palau limestones, which formed on the bottom of the ocean and then were upthrust in volcanic upliftment, erode very rapidly in geological terms, in thousands of years. They erode very rapidly, and thus the caves inside of them, when the water drips, it carries enormous amounts of lime. And it's that lime that is preserving and replacing these Palawan fossils. It's not very different at all to what goes on at our famous fossil sites out here, Sterkfontein, just that the rock... the limestone's a little softer, so it erodes a little faster, so fossilization occurs just a little bit quicker.
Fascinating. Let's go to Nusia. Hi there, Nusia.
Hello. Good afternoon, Jenny, and good afternoon to Professor Berger. I find this fascinating because I read a book which was written 100 years ago, and one of the comments in the book was the fact that horses, which were imported from Europe to Africa, over generations became smaller because of the difference in the fodder and whatever, you know. And they apparently developed straighter legs and so on. Now, of course, this doesn't affect the modern horses because we have a lot of imported horses for breeding. But I just found it very interesting that presumably the same thing happens with all mammals.
That's exactly right. And that was one of the points. Sometimes we scientists can be a little bit stubborn, particularly when it comes to humans themselves, where we really want to see it demonstrated in humans. And there has been an argument among scientists as to whether humans could actually undergo that kind of stress because of culture. That is, that we're the ultimate adapters of our environment. It now turns out, certainly I think Palau has pretty conclusively demonstrated that island dwarfism, that just what you're talking about, under dietary stress, under genetic stress, and under all kinds of other stresses that occur in these isolated environments, just like the horses you're talking to, that humans can shrink and change remarkably rapidly.
That's fascinating. Thank you.
Thanks, Nusia. And let's go to Ryan. Hi there, Ryan.
Hi. Thanks for the show. Very interesting. Just two questions. The first relates almost to the question that was just asked, and that is, have you seen any fossil evidence for animals that have undergone a similar scale of change in terms of their size once they were brought to the island. Mm. And then the second question, which is sort of not quite related, but on the other side of the spectrum, I guess, is one reads these intriguing mentions in the Bible of giants in ancient days, etc. As far as the fossil record is concerned, is there any evidence for this sort of thing existing? I'll listen on the radio.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, super. Well, the first thing is, yes, there are lots and lots of examples of island dwarfism going on in large mammals. The one that comes to mind very quickly is the example of stegodons. Stegodons, which are a relative of the elephant, are very commonly known to get on islands and shrink and change and alter incredibly rapidly, going from an animal the size of an elephant to the animal the size of a Shetland pony within a very short time period. Interestingly enough, just as an aside, small animals tend to do the reverse on islands. Mm-hmm. That is, so that lizards become huge, you get Komodo dragons and things like that. Tortoises become giant, the Galapagos tortoises, and things like rats become supersized bread loaf-sized animals on islands. And so big animals get small, and small animals tend to get big. And there's lots and lots and lots of that. To your second question, I was interestingly involved in research right here in South Africa about 4 or 5 years ago. And if you watch National Geographic Channel periodically, you'll see a television show I was involved in called Ultimate Survivor, which actually looks at some giants that we found. So right here on the west coast of South Africa, at a place called Saldanha, my team and I found what are truly giant people. We couldn't even actually measure how tall they were because we had to use effectively basketball player type individuals to measure them. They were upwards of, though, around 2.1 meters tall. And that is enormous if you think that that's the average. They were scattered around southern Africa from about maybe 250,000 years ago back to about 500,000 years ago. So I've interestingly then been involved in two studies looking at the two extremes, in fact, that you can push humans to, the very biggest and now the very smallest.
I thought that humans, once they reached a certain size, I mean, you look at pictures of people who are almost 2 meters, and they seem to suffer from back problems, breaking legs and all of that sort of thing. In other words, their bodies almost can't sustain them.
Well, what was interesting about these ones that we found is that everything about them was supersized. Mm. You know, they would be the ultimate Texan. The bones themselves, because of the stresses of being big, had much more cortex. They were thicker than what we would expect to see in modern humans. These were really, really big guys. And you can see across the muscle markings on them were enormous. So they were big in every way to compensate for just that kind of thing. When you look at a big person, modern human, they're in fact abnormal in some
ways. Exactly.
That is, that they're at the extreme edge. These guys, this was the norm. They were adapted to that. I do sometimes wonder what a really big one of them must have looked like. A pretty scary thing.
What would make somebody grow? We understand what would make somebody grow small in a very, very short period of time. What would make you grow big?
We're not really sure, to be quite frank. These fossils are incredibly elusive, and we have only found a few dozen of them scattered across sites in southern Africa. But what we are hypothesizing is it occurred during a relatively dry period, and it was an adaptation to the emergent grasslands in southern Africa and the mega herbivores, the large herbivores that were occurring at that time, and the emergence of hunting that was going along with that. That is, that the prey was big and suddenly they needed to be big.
What comes next now in this thing? You've made this discovery. There's hectic infighting about it, which can go on for generations.
That's
practically.
Right. That's right.
I mean, it can, until something or other is going to resolve it one way or another. But what comes next for you now?
Well, there are two directions I'm going to take. One is that we'll go back to Palau. I, on my little meanderings around on the last visit, I did happen across a couple of other caves with just these kind of things in them, some very interesting ones. And we will continue that. But I'm going to be training some Palauans. We're going to be setting up a team. Someone will be coming here to train under us to take these excavations over, because now we got to dig. I mean, these caves, Jenny, are full of tens of thousands of bones. The actual physical ground is made up of ground-up human bone. So there are lifetimes of work in each cave that we found. I found two so far, but I've actually found a few more than that now. But there are lifetimes of work in each and every one of those caves. So I'm going to get that in position, get the funding in place, get the training of the scientists in place, and get Palauans doing, going after their own history. The second thing I'm going to do is I'm going to be starting a program to educate archaeologists, geologists, and other paleontologists around recognizing, identifying human variation. One thing came clearly to me in this. We need a bunch of eyes out there to find remarkable, remarkable things. There must be thousands of discoveries like this to be made in Africa, the Indo-Pacific, Asia, South America, and even North America. How many people are sitting there with these fantastic fossils right in front of them and just don't recognize how important they are? I'm going to actually dedicate the next couple of years to building a training program that can be given to these type of scientists, professionals, and teach them to see these things and to say, hey, is this important or not? And then get that information to people who can do something about it.
Now, I didn't ask you whether these people were Homo sapiens. Are they Homo sapiens?
We have called them Homo sapiens. We do not think that they vary enough outside of modern human variation to be called a new species. But, of course, being the controversial field this is, we publish this in the most fantastic journal, an open access journal called PLOS. Any one of your viewers can go to PLOS One. I think it's www.plos1.org, and they can read this paper. And they can read the reviews of this paper, and they can see scientists interacting and discussing live on the net. And it's a real new experiment in information exchange, and it's something I'm very passionate about. But one of the interesting things, to answer your question, is that some scientists have jumped in immediately and said, you should have named a new species. We expected that. I still don't think we should have, but some people are going to argue we should have.
But pygmies, for instance, are Homo sapiens.
Absolutely. Don't vary one iota out of what the observed range of modern humans are, by definition. We are stretching. If the things that we have found, if the about 26-odd individuals that we discuss in this paper are the norm of the population, we are probably stretching the known variation of populations of modern humans today. But not by much, but that in of itself is opening up the most fascinating, interesting, and important debate.
Now, Easter Island, at least not Easter Island, Pitcairn Island.
Yeah.
Now, Pitcairn Island, very remote. It's also got its own problems.
It's in fact an exact example of probably what happened on Palau. These are the stories of Captain Bligh and Mutiny on the Bounty and all those fantastic things. Pitcairn Island is, in fact, where one of the things that we are actually proving in Palau, one of the anthropological hypotheses was posited. That is a founder effect. The sailors who mutinied on the Bounty went there with their women, and they hid there. And they hid there for a very, very long time, decades and decades, generations, in fact. And when they were refound, they carried with them many recessive traits which were not known as common in the whole global population of humans. That's what we're seeing in Palau, an experiment that carried on over more than 1,000 years.
When you say they went there with their women, I don't think they did. I think that there were mostly males on board the Bounty.
Oh, yes, but they captured some lovely Polynesian women, and that's where that whole familial situation started.
And therefore, there's been a lot of inbreeding because there was very, very little input from outside. Did you know that Colleen McCulloch, who wrote The Thornbirds, has married a Pitcairn Islander? Quite interesting. I didn't know that.
I did actually know that. And, that's a classic case of founder effect. And what the neat thing about something like this recent discovery is we're seeing what would happen if that experiment had been allowed to carry on.
Yes. So if their isolation had continued, you were going to see, I mean, we already know that they've got customs on Pitcairn Island that are unacceptable elsewhere.
But their morphology, their very genetics was already changing in just a few generations. So that's an exact example of how much pressure on evolution an island can create.
I mean, I think the whole thing is completely fascinating. And so where you live and whether there are whether that gene pool is refreshed the whole time is absolutely critical.
It's fundamentally critical.
To the advancement of humankind.
That's right.
It just absolutely is. Whether it's the steppes of Russia or whether it is somewhere or other in the Western Cape.
That is absolutely true.
And, of course, if they couldn't get lots and lots of fish, then, I mean, I can remember a conversation with you saying fish is what did it for us because that those
seafood.
Huge amounts of protein.
That's right. And long-chain fatty amino acids.
Exactly so. All right, we're chatting to Lee Berger, and we're going to run out of time soon. So if you've got any questions, give us a quick call, 883-0702. Let's check out the traffic. All right, some SMS questions. Pam wonders where these people originally came from. India, maybe, but I thought you said Micronesia.
Well, we don't. This Palau is in Micronesia. We don't know where they came from. I have labs working very hard on trying to extract ancient DNA from these bones.
Can you?
Well, I'm not going to answer that question right now, because if we can, it's a very, very important thing. But it is not an easy process, and it's one that you have to be very careful of contamination and other issues. But my suspicion, based upon some aspects of the morphology, like the teeth of these individuals, suggest to me that they come actually from the west. That is, that they're coming from the direction of the Java, Flores, all the way down towards the Austronesian belt. That would be my best guess at this time. I think I can be pretty confident in telling you within a year or so I'll be able to give you that answer. That.
Very fascinating. Let's take Conrad's question before we go to the other ones. Hello, Conrad.
Hi, Jenny.
Yes.
And hello, Prof.
Hello.
I was just wondering, I don't know, I suppose you've heard of Hovind. I think it's Dr. Hovind.
I'm not sure. Refresh me.
Not specifically. Well, he's done a bunch of experiments in which he's proven some rapid fossilization theories where they've gotten various plant materials fossilized under 5 years. They've actually got proof of fossilized cowboy boots. Some very interesting things. And I know he's got amongst some of his research, he's got quite a couple of these giant humans. I know they found a cave somewhere in Minnesota, I believe, that was filled with about 50 of them that averaged about 3 meters per person. They ranged all the way up to 5 meters.
Yeah, no, that actually isn't true. That part of I know that story very, very well. That's a bit of what you would call scientific urban legend. The first part about fossilization occurring very quickly, as I said, you know, fossilization is all it means is the replacement of what is there by something else.
Yeah,
fossilization can occur very, very rapidly, but it can also take a very, very long time. It depends on how that fossilization in the process and the conditions that bone or artifact or whatever finds itself in.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, no, I see. Well, then also to the previous caller that inquired about the giants, I could advise him to go check out Dr. Hovind's site. You can maybe just Google it. He's got some very interesting theories relating to the Bible and the whole evolution theory and all that.
Conrad, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks very much.
Many, many thanks. And just going back here, this is a question from Zuko. Is our height proportional to our environment or where we live?
Okay, that's not an easy question to answer. The individual, any group or population's height, their features and such have a lot of complex things. One, it's what we were talking about a moment ago, the concept of founder effect. What did the original founding population look like? Was it tall? Did it have a heavy build or a slight build? Secondly, when you add in issues like environmental stresses to that original clay, if you will, we can radically alter. So if you're under high stress situations from a dietary perspective, and that high stress can come in surprising ways. That is, it can come in the form of being urban or eating a relatively low diversity of food, so that For example, we archaeologists, when we find the origins of civilizations and the origins of agriculture, people actually shrink in size and become less healthy because they're beginning to rely on a fewer number of foods instead of the diversity that hunter-gatherers do. And then the third thing that can come into that is culture. That is selection. That is, some cultures will select for tall people. Some people, cultures will select for blue eyes or fat people or short people. And so there can be sexual selection. All of those things are important. And in each and every case in examining a population, it may be one has more importance than the other, or they're all equally important.
Okay, so very, very complex. And here we go. How few people constitute a viable gene pool before inbreeding occurs?
We don't have any idea. That is sort of the forbidden experiment, if you will. There have been all kinds of examinations by zoologists in particular to look at how low can you go in the numbers. And unfortunately, we're going to see those experiments in many, many different large mammals today due to what humans have done. Black rhinos being some, gorillas certainly being some, bonobos, pygmy chimpanzees. Many of the tigers are down to such critical levels that we're going to get a very good example of just how tiny you can go to see what a viable population. But, you know, funny enough, if you look at the Palauans, my guess is it was minute. It might have been just a few people that
started.
When
you say few, under 20?
I'm even saying maybe a raft load. Maybe two or three.
Yes, okay.
And you know, viable has different meanings. You know, one of the problems is that many times if someone says, oh, that population's not viable, what they mean is a viable population can breed without producing genetic abnormalities. Well, if you're not worried about the genetic abnormalities and the morphological changes, i.e. you're almost allowing speciation to occur, then you can start with one pregnant female and let it go on from there. Sometimes you can get critical genetic abnormalities that cause infertility and stuff, and the population stops. But, you know, you can get pretty darn small, I would think.
How would this population have been wiped out? Because it was.
Well, we have two ideas. One is the sort of unpleasant one. That is that these large Lapita, Polynesian-type people sailed over the horizon in their outrigger sailing canoes about 1,400 years ago or so. And ate them, or, you know, unfortunately, out there in
Have you found teeth?
No. They just vanish. And, you know, unfortunately, in the Indo-Pacific, you know, cannibalism stuff, these islands are low on resources, and you can't be too precious about what you're eating. Or they were wiped out physically.
What's it called, long pig?
That's one word
but
for
in this,
cannibalism.
In this instance,
yeah.
Short pig.
That's right. Sure. The second thing is they came in and wiped them out.
Clapped
just
them
to,
over the head, sort
through
of thing.
Violence. The third is that they integrated them into their population, particularly the females, as is wont to do. Humans are not generally very picky. I think we'll learn a lot about that with the DNA.
Okay, so but that's not a given.
That's not
a given. And anyway, that's a wait of about a year.
That's right.
So if the DNA is positive, if you are able to, then obviously you're going to be taking DNA from the current islanders.
That's right. We have, in fact, volunteers who have already done that. Although the problem with the current islanders is that they are very diverse in their origins. They were conquered by the Germans. They were conquered by the Japanese. They were conquered by the Americans. And so there's a lot of, and of course they were originally Lapita, but we'll pick it up. And it'll really depend on just what that ancient DNA tells us. It may be so radically out of place that we know immediately that they have no relationship in modern Palauans.
Well, I mean, the whole thing is very, very fascinating. And presumably there are going to be papers about this. There are going to be television documentaries.
There's one coming in about 2 weeks to South Africa.
A television documentary.
That's right.
Okay.
Called... Now, this one is called the reason I'm struggling is that it's already aired last week in the United States under the title Mystery Skulls of Palau, but I think it's coming out worldwide as Lost Tribe of Palau. And the date that I've been given is April 14th in standard definition and April 24th in high definition here on the National Geographic Channel.
Okay, so we've just got to watch our television programs and just see. But Lee, congratulations. Very, very fascinating. But I imagine that this is just the beginning.
It absolutely is. And I, you know, I do this to you every time, but just watch this space.
Oh, for goodness sake, not another one. Where are the photographs? Show me. Lee Berger, thank you so much.
Bye-bye, Jenny. My pleasure.
Join me, Lee.